This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches.
Okay, welcome to the podcast. I'm sat here with Billy Rydell. And Billy, you are a coach here at Lattice, and we are going to sit down over a cup of tea on this cold winter's day to chat a little bit about your past year of climbing, mostly because this has involved quite a lot of interesting transitions for you. And it also culminated in a free ascent of the nose, which is obviously pretty amazing, especially given that big wall climbing is quite a new thing to you as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a big year for me in terms of transition of what my focuses are within climbing. And as you said, this was kind of the culmination of that. So yeah, the comps were kind of this natural progression. I just went to the BRICS, it's the YCS now in the UK, competed in that for a little while. And that fed through to the junior team and competing internationally there. It was just sort of,
you just funneled.
Yeah, exactly. Like, as a kid, it wasn't really a conscious decision that I was going to be a competition climber. It kind of just went that way. But then when I got to the senior level and I sort of had more of an understanding of what it required and how much I needed to put into it, it was very much a conscious decision of, this is going to be my priority. I'm going to put everything that I can into comps and go as far as I can with that. And in order to do that, climbing outside will have to be secondary. So that, for a long time, I was doing that, and the bits of climbing that I would do outside was more for fun, and I was still trying to push myself in that area, but it was never, my training was never towards that. That was never the end goal. It was always with the competitions. But when it comes to actual LCAP, I'm not sure when the sort of idea was fully sewn in my head. Like, I grew up watching films and like Leo Holding on The Prophet and the stuff like that, and obviously Tommy on the Door Wall, all those stuff. I've always found that really inspiring. So the idea of going and sort of figuring out what that was about has been in my head for a really long time. Specifically the nose, I think that came about a bit more recently, as because it felt like the right sort of level of goal for it to be, feel kind of unrealistic and a bit ridiculous, but like it might just be achievable. And that kind of line on the edge is something that I've always found really appealing, and something that's I always got from competitions. You can always sort of have a slightly bigger goal that feels a little bit too far away, but maybe you could get to it, sort of thing.
Those are the sort of goals you're drawn to, because people, you know, some people are drawn to things that feel much more achievable because it's not as overwhelming, and you're that, and that's really motivating to them to see that it could really, really be possible.
Yeah.
Whereas I guess maybe it sounds like with you, you liked more of that unknown of being like, well, you really don't know how it's going to turn out. Because I guess that's the thing with comps. I mean, I know there are some people who turn up time and time again and perform well, but things change around a lot, don't they? You never really quite know how it's going to go. So it sounds like you took that from the comps and applied that to the big goals.
Yeah, because up until that point, all the sort of smaller goals that I'd had for climbing outside, they'd pretty much always been things that I was quite confident I could do, because I had this huge scary goal in the comps. I'm like, I don't need anything else to. Whereas when I'd made the decision to walk away from comps, I was looking for that big sort of scary objective to chase. And so me and Alex, Alex retired maybe a few months before me, but essentially we came out of the competition scene more or less at the same time, and having conversations about what we wanted to do next, whether within climbing and otherwise, just sort of what the hell we're going to do with ourselves, basically, because we've had this singular focus for so long.
Yeah.
And trying to climb the nose was what we came up with as our sort of ridiculous goal to drive towards, basically.
Yeah, because it must be hard when you've had so much focus on one thing to step away from that and be like, right, okay.
Yeah.
What's the next thing? And it sounds like having something really big really fit that gap that was now there.
I think this is true for most people that have competed to quite a high level. Mm. And I think it must be way worse in other sports which are less lifestyle-y. We've grown up with this focus. Up until that point, the whole of our adult lives has been purely focused on this one goal. And then when you make the decision to step away with it, there's just this huge hole in your life. I needed to fill it with something. And I'm very glad that I'm in a sport where you can just choose a different objective. Like if I was a pole vaulter or whatever, like there's not an LCAP of pole vaulting to go and do afterwards, right?
Well, there might be, you don't
maybe,
know.
Maybe there is, I don't know anything about the sport.
But yeah, there's maybe not such a natural kind of transition that's available and like really obvious to other sports. But yeah, I think climbing is such a kind of lifetime passion, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
What did your preparation look like? And I guess that maybe, obviously there's a lot, there's the climbing as well, but maybe first and foremost, like the actual practicalities of, I don't know, learning to haul, all the gear you would need.
Well, I mean, whether or not it's the best advice or not, but in terms of figuring out logistics, a lot of it was just watching an astronomical amount of YouTube videos. I think I became a little bit almost not very communicative at home, because I'd just be like constantly trying to figure out some new thing that I was watching videos about hauling, or yeah, different ways to set up anchors, or what the hell you do with a port ledge, figuring out poop logistics, all that sort of stuff. So I spent an awful lot of time doing that, and then getting out in the Peak District, trying to find styles of climbs that were sort of relevant. So I spent a reasonable amount of time at Millstone, just because it's the only place in the Peak District which has Pinscars, which is the most relevant style I could find to Yosemite. It's obviously grit rather than granite, so the way that you go about it is quite different. But it did at least have some relevance in terms of the type of gear placements and some technicality in terms of like finger locks and stuff in that. It was funny actually. I went out to, basically the first day I went back out trad climbing after we decided to do this, I went out and got on London Wall. Super, super classic E5 at Millstone, which I sort of thought would be a good level to get back into things on, which did not really turn out to be the case. It has a kind of tricky crux off the ground, and then it gets a little bit easier for a little while. Got through the harder bit of climbing, I think, because I couldn't really think too much about the gear placements, and then suddenly realised that I was on a trad climb and you're in a potentially serious situation, and I had absolutely no faith in my gear placement whatsoever. I went into like total panic mode. I've got like an hour and a half video of me on London Wall where I like get to a position and like try to place a bit of gear, don't like it, shake out a little bit, try to place another bit of gear, don't like it, and I'm in like the same positions like 50 minutes straight, just like shaking out. It's like the best arcing session I've ever had in my life.
Well, that's when you're like, pretty glad that you've got the strength.
Yeah. But it was a shambles, basically. I ended up resting on the rope a few times, made myself take the fall on the end once I was happy that I had some good gear in. But it was a big wake-up call that I was not psychologically prepared to be in like serious positions on track climbing, basically. I need to sort it out.
Was that motivating? Was it a little daunting that you
had? At that point, very daunting. It was a kind of a realisation that I'd underestimated where I needed to be psychologically. I just sort of assumed that I was going to be happy if I could tell myself that a piece of gear was bomber. But at that point, I would look at a bomber piece of gear and still assume I was like basically free soloing in the death zone. After that, spent quite a lot of time getting out on easier trad climbs than that in situations where I was going to be a bit more comfortable. Throwing myself off onto bits of gear which I knew were really, really good, and just trying to sort of build up a little bit rather than throwing myself in the deep end, which I did a little bit the first time. And did sort of had about 6 weeks of that before going out to the US, where I built up some amount of confidence, tried to get quite a lot of volume in. I did a day of running across Stanage, just doing loads and loads of climbs, and try and get a bit of sense of volume on that sort of terrain. But really, it turned up to the US not really having any sense of whether I was remotely prepared for what we were trying to do. And Alex, too, like, he'd been doing some bits and bobs in and around where he is in Colorado. He'd got some, like, bigger stuff to do there, so he'd been out on some kind of bigger days of, like, 6-8 pitch stuff. But, yeah, basically, we were going to get there, have a few days in Colorado to climb together, and then go to Indian Creek on the drive across and do some climbing there as well and try and get a bit of confidence moving through cracks. But yeah,
was there a second round of daunting shock when you climbed in Indian Creek? Did you have any sort of like...
Well, so Indian Creek kind of went a bit awry in terms of what our objective was. We were supposed to be going there and doing like a bunch of stuff in the 510 to 512 region from Fingers all the way through to Offwhip and just like gaining a bit of confidence on loads of different crack sizes. But instead, we just got there and decided we were going to try Belly Full of Bad Berries, which, for anybody that doesn't know, is a 45-degree overhung off width, which is...
You climb feet first. It's yes, like an inversion.
It's
thing,
not a
it?
Relevant style to LCAP or Yosemite in general, really. So we went and ended up trying that and trying to do inverted off width climbing for the first time ever. Which went very well for Alex. He flashed it, which has been really impressive.
Absolutely. Really like, impressive. So awesome. Yeah. I think it really shows a level of just really general athletic skill, I think. Because when I've done, I had a go at that kind of inverted off-width style, of course it's really technical. But once you've learned the technique, it's just a full-on kind of battle. Yeah. It's like a sort of... You know, when you watch swimmers training that kind of in that anaerobic zone, that's kind of what it's like.
Yeah, very much so. Which I think is, in terms of that, like, determination to fight to the death on a route, like, we've definitely both got that from competing and being really competitive with one another. Like, definitely setting up to that route, we were both like, we want to do well on it. But yes, Alex flashed it, which was really impressive. I did not have... I think I had the more appropriate experience the first time you're going on a route off whip, where I basically just suffered really, really, really badly. There's like a sort of resting jug 2/3 of the way up it, where the style changes and it gets... for any off whip aficionados, you go into a wide pony stance after this, where you turn both your legs out, and it gets a little bit easier from there. I've got this video of about 15 minutes of the 1 meter of crack below this resting jug, where I sort of make a few inches up and then slide back down it, and then go a few inches back up and then slide back down it. And then eventually have to have like hanging just hands in the crack, just sliding out to my demise.
It's
on
the roof. So ungraceful, isn't it? Yeah. Falling off and off.
Yeah.
The thing is, or I don't know, it'd be interesting what you think. Obviously, it wasn't specific really for LCAP, but something I found when I've gone to Yosemite in general, but on LCAP particularly, is it's a humbling experience. Mm-hmm. And I think it really pays to go into it feeling quite humble.
Yeah.
So maybe did you feel like it kind of did that for you?
Yeah. I think kind of through the whole thing, really, we'd set this big goal, but we didn't really have any sense of how achievable it was, how we didn't even know what we didn't know. Like we're so detached from what doing that really means at that point that you could kind of only really be quite just sort of open to everything that was coming your way and just trying to take it as a learning experience rather than something that we were trying to obviously we were trying to succeed on it, but we were going in very comfortable with the possibility that we were going to get totally shut down, and that was okay.
Did you have a plan B at all? As in, like, if you tried it and you were totally shut down, had you guys discussed that? Was there, or was it like, we're going to go, we will spend our trip on this route where, and see where that takes us?
Well, I think to start with, we were kind of kidding ourselves a little bit that we were going to go to Yosemite and like have a bit more of the traditional experience and then just have a go at the nose. So we were going to like get on the rostrum and things like that and go through some of the classics and like sort of cut our teeth a little bit. But we didn't do that at all. We got there, looked up at the nose, like, that's amazing. And then the following morning went straight up it, multi-pitched dive from the bottom. And then the day after that, we were walking to the top to try the top pitches. And very quickly, we decided that we weren't getting on anything else that trip. So
you were fully committed.
Yes. As soon as we actually got there and we were getting a bit more of a sense of what it meant, it was very clear that that's all we were going to get on. But there wasn't really a plan B at that point. We were like, we're going to spend our whole trip on this. And if it doesn't happen, it didn't happen. We learn a lot of stuff.
I think that that's really cool. How were you feeling on gear then? You know, once you got out, did you feel more confident? Like, well, your prep had helped, you know, from that day in Millstone on London Wall?
Yeah.
Did you really feel that difference?
I was definitely feeling a lot better. Like, we'd taken some falls in Indian Creek, like falling headfirst out of a roof crack, even if it's not relevant, is definitely good for your head, I think. But even if I'd gained a bit of faith in actual gear at that point, that hadn't remotely prepared me for being on a big wall. And the funny way with our approach to the nose, like we weren't just going to go bottom up. We did that on the first day just to get a bit of a sense of it before abseiling off. But then the first day that felt like big walling was when we walked up to the top and then abseiled down to work on the changing corners pitch. And that basically means that you just ab off the top into 3,000 feet of space. And the top pitch of the nose is like these series of sort of overlapping bulges. So you literally just hang in, like go over this edge, and then you just have this absurd amount of exposure the moment you go off. And it's flipping terrifying if you've not done that before. So no, I did not feel confident those first few days. We like abseiled down to changing corners and both of us were like totally spooked by the situation. We ended up working the pitch with two top ropes because we were absolutely terrified. We've got like several layers of redundancy attaching ourselves to the rope and just trying to make it feel as like completely over bomb proof as we possibly could because we were totally freaked out by it.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's not that shocking that climbing sort of 15-meter routes at Millstone doesn't prepare you for abseiling off an 1,000-meter cliff. But, you know, and it'd be interesting to hear how you were with the exposure when you climbed from the bottom, because my experience is definitely when I've climbed from the bottom of El Cap up, it's not so bad. Mm. But I've abbed in once, and I mean, I was gripping the rope, you know, it was the only thing holding me to the wall. It's interesting, isn't it? Like this sort of, you really get this sense of how irrational some of that fear is. I mean, it's totally makes sense to feel the exposure, but you know, having two top ropes, like feeling like you want to bring everything to make yourself feel so secure.
Yeah, because in reality, the situation is no different to being 15 meters up at Millstone. If it goes wrong, the outcome is the same at that point. But that exposure, it's when you've not had that time to acclimate to it and you're just thrown into it. It's totally freaked both of us out. But like over the course of being there, we did get a lot more comfortable with that. Like we didn't need two top ropes every time we went to work the pitch, fortunately. And then we had a couple more days where we went up from the bottom, kind of multi-pitching and then abseiling off. And we had kind of our only real sort of actual big walling prep that we had was we did a full abseil of El Cap to work some of the pitches. So
El Rapitan,
exactly, which Alex coined, where we walked all the way up to the top and then with all of our big walling stuff, and abseil down, spent a day on changing corners, then abseil down the, another five pitches to the Great Roof, and then set up camp there for a couple of days, and then abseiled all the way to the bottom. So it actually felt like we'd gone big walling, even if it was in the wrong direction.
Yeah, rather than cracking with a lot of exposure.
So we had those all these little stages to sort of build on, build our big walling skills and like gradually introduce ourselves to being in that situation. So by the time it came to us actually going from the bottom up, we didn't feel experienced, but we felt like relatively comfortable with the situation and what we were trying to do, I suppose.
Well, then you're starting to chunk it as a project. It's interesting, isn't it? I think wildly technical climbing.
Yes.
And it's got a reputation for being that. I don't think anyone who's climbed the nose, you don't think of them as someone who just is good at going and pulling on holds.
Yeah, yeah. It's about understanding your body and understanding how to read rock and stuff. So that we were really excited about, but we didn't, all we knew was that changing corners gets a grade of 514A or 8B plus, and it's got a reputation for being really hard and really technical. But we have got no sense of what that actually means. Like it's, we've never climbed on Yosemite granite before. We've not done any of these styles. So I know what 8B plus means to me on a limestone sport route, but that has no resemblance whatsoever to a granite groove with a few pin scars in it. So the first couple of days on changing corners, it was harder than I was expecting it to be. I was expecting it to be hard, but it was beyond my expectations and how hard it was going to be. Just because, I'm pretty confident in the grade of 8B plus. So even if the style is totally foreign, I guess I had a little bit in my head of like, it can't be that hard, right? But it was. It really, really was. And we didn't really figure out much of a sequence in, especially in the first day. Like we came away having done the odd move, but not really having all that much of a sequence. And it's an interesting one as well, because it's that pitch has been climbed in completely different ways. In terms of, to describe it, it's called changing corners quite literally because you transition between two corners. You start up like a fairly easy crack, like 5-10 crack for about 20 meters. You get to a no hands rest, then you reach out to the arete and you have to transition yourself into this groove, which has not really anything in it that I describe as a proper hold. You've got the arete and you've got some smears and you've got some bad pin scars in the back. But for about 8 meters before it starts to widen out in the back, there's just not really any, there's no good holds. And that section, it's been climbed by Lynn Hill back in the day by essentially transitioning into the groove straight away and just doing some ludicrous wizardry. As I said, like elbows going back in opposite directions and getting loads out of these pin scars. It's also been climbed by Babsy Zangirl and Jacopo by basically just laybacking the lip of the groove the whole way. I think when they were
did
on
they
it,
use knee pads? Did they sort used, of like get used, some knee scums in?
Yeah, I think they used knee pads. But I think for them, basically, the pin scars in the back were wet. So they just found this other solution of just staying out the whole way and using knees. And yeah, both of those two extremes seem totally mental to me. My intuition with getting inside the groove is that it helps to be a bit smaller on that with that method. The only other person that's done it that way is Connor Herson, who climbed it when he was 15, who now can't do it that way anymore. So me and Alex ended up doing this kind of in between method where we'd stay a bit on the arete and then come into the groove for a move or two and then go back out onto the arete and then come back in. Using one knee for a bit of a scum. But there's so much going on in that, like, the way that most people sort of understand climbing from bouldering or sport climbing or just being in the gym is you climb with four points of contact, right? You have your hands and your feet and you go to this hold and then you move your foot there. Whereas with this, there's every part of your body is a potential contact point.
Yeah.
And it just makes it so much more complex to string a sequence together. And the point that I found really hard was being able to then hold that sequence in your head as well, because I'm used to visualizing climbing in a certain way from comps and stuff, and that was always something that I kind of thought of as a strength, of being able to really go into a lot of depth with like a competition route or something and then just execute it exactly as I had in my mind. Whereas with this, it was so much more complex that I just, for a long time, I couldn't hold the sequence in my head, and I'd look up at it and be like, oh, maybe I do this like that, but oh no, maybe that goes in first. And
you have to still allow some of the intuition, I think, in your body, don't you? I think it doesn't work in the same way on that style of climbing to be thinking of yourself as a four-point climber, with your fingers in your toes. And I think once you move away from that, you have to maintain a certain amount of intuition, which is challenging, because I think when we visualize, we're trying to bring it more under our control, the route, and memorize it. And I think I've seen people who are good on granite and something, even just the intuition I think you need for like hard laybacking sequences, for like where you put your feet, that's something I found hard to get my head around as someone who's come from, I guess we have a lot of crimpier sport climbing in this country, which is, it's so, like you said, you can put your foot there on this hold that looks like a foothold.
Yeah, and you can...
The granite's not like that on L-cap.
You can quite concisely kind of describe a sequence for climbing on limestone or something like that. Like, this is a hold, you hold it here. Whereas with the granite, you've just got... Everything is a potential feature, but also kind of nothing is, especially in that circumstance.
It's like, did Johnny Dawes say Stannage was one big foothold?
It totally feels like that. And it never quite felt the same every time you went up there. Like, your foot would be slightly differently placed on the smear, or you'd end up sort of placing your hip into the groove a little bit differently, or you'd be a little bit too low or a bit too high going into a pin scar, and then the way you'd interact with it would be different. Yeah, you could kind of get as close as you could in terms of a sequence, but every single time you went up there, it was a little bit of sort of see what happens and roll with the punches a little bit.
Did you feel like you managed to like establish a new kind of way of visualizing it that worked? Or did you feel like you just had to let go of not, like you said, a bit more like just actually changing your mindset to being like, well, when you get to the base of this pitch, you just sort of give it a go and see how it goes.
Yeah, I definitely had got to a point where I was visualizing it to a certain extent, but like I'd be visualizing like a little like thrutch and sort of going like ugh, in position. It's like as much as you can visualize that, I suppose, when it's, there's so much variation in that little movement every single time. But I definitely had got to the point where I could go through a version of the sequence in my head and allow for a few variations throughout it. Because it's an interesting style where you could do a move perfectly and then find yourself really insecure on the next position. And sometimes that would compound. If you got like a few moves wrong in a row, it would compound and then you'd be done. But if you made like a small error, you could kind of get yourself back to feeling good again, which is a bit different to what I've had in bouldering or sport climbing in the past, where usually you're so close to your physical capacity that a small error would be pretty terminal. Whereas with this, you could go a little bit awry and you could kind of get it back a little bit, but you'd never actually feel comfortable in any of the positions.
It's interesting, isn't it, that I think for the kind of the headspace as well as the physical effort, because you sort of really have to stick with it, even though it's feeling so insecure. And I think a temptation, especially when you work pitches, is that they will start to feel more and more controlled or perfect,
and
or
and
obviously with in some cases that is how the process goes, but it sounds like this, even as a single pitch, as a red pointing a pitch, sounds like it really wasn't like your same experience of other outdoor red points.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because you could just never ever be confident in it when you were going on. You could kind of, you could slip off pretty much any move through the crux sequence. And normally it would be because, well, your foot would nearly always be the failing point. It wouldn't necessarily be because the foot placement was bad, like something else could be wrong, but it would pretty much always be the foot that went. So yeah, for the entire time that you're going through that crux sequence, you just kind of feel like you're right on the edge, and you're kind of rolling the dice with every move, and they're just, the dice are also like stacking on top of each other through it, and you're just sort of hoping that you get the right roll, basically. Which is quite frustrating just as a single pitch, because you could just, it feels like you could just slip off it forever. Which is then particularly stressful when you've got there from the bottom and you don't really have much sense of whether it's going to come together.
And you've only got like a limited amount of time. Yes. And like sort of with you and Alex sort of having these similarities and differences in your climbing, did you climb it the same way? Was your guys' trajectory somewhat similar, or?
So we actually ended up with a pretty similar sequence for changing corners. There was a few bits that we did differently, but if you watch the footage back of the two of us, it would probably look more or less the same to most people. There's a few subtle differences. But yeah, we did end up coming out relatively similarly. In terms of the trajectory on that pitch, we had 7 working sessions on it total. From maybe session 5, something like that, it really looked like it was coming together for Alex. He was starting to be more consistent through the sequences. And then either in session 6 or session 7, he did actually link the entire crux sequence. I never did. By the end of it, I very much got to the point where it felt possible. I think I'd done it in sort of basically in 2 sections. But I was definitely not at the point where I was kind of confident that I could do it.
So when you set off from the ground,
it felt like
you hadn't actually linked it. Yeah.
Alex was relatively confident he could put it together by the end of those 7 working sessions. I would have liked some more time up there, but we didn't have it. We needed to go, basically.
Did the time just fly by, I bet?
It went fast, yeah, because we were in Yosemite for a month, but because everything takes so much work, like we have to do this huge hike to get to the top to work it every single time. So, it doesn't feel like you have a great deal of downtime, and the downtime that you do have goes really, really fast because you're absolutely exhausted. So it kind of just felt like we were like on the accelerator the whole time. And then suddenly we only really had a week left of the trip, and if we were going to go for it, we needed to go for it. We went from the bottom.
Literally have sort of 7 days left of your trip? The flight was like looming for you, right?
Yes, basically. So we ended up setting off a day earlier than we were planning to, actually, because our plan was we'd stash some water when we'd been up from the top at Camp 6, which is the last good ledge before the top and directly below changing corners. Then a couple of days before we were going to go from the bottom, we'd hauled the bag up to Dalt Tower, which is the first like big ledge, and we'd leaving most of our stuff there so that when we came from the bottom, we could kind of fly through the bottom bit without having to haul. We did that, and then the weather changed, and there was these couple of days where it was looking like it was going to rain. And we kind of either had the option of waiting until the rain finished and then only having 5 days before my flight home, which felt like basically to do it in 5 days was going to be no wiggle room. We kind of just needed to bang out the hard pitches pretty much straight away. Or we go a day earlier and have 8 days total, get ourselves up to Camp 4, which is below the Great Roof, before the rain comes, and then sit it out there. And then we'd have three to four days after that to then get to the top. So we decided to do that. First couple of days went pretty well. The start of the noses, in terms of grade, isn't supposed to be any particularly difficult pitches. The hardest thing is 12A, but I think there's some hard moves down there. The whole route is set up for aid climbing. It's like the most popular aid route in the world. So like, it's really well equipped. Like, you've got really good anchors, but it's not set up for free climbing it. And there's all these sections where you'll, as an aid climber, you'll like go up to a bolt and you'll do something called a lower out. You lower down the rope and then you do a swing across to get into the next crack system. And those bits are usually where the free climbing gets hard because, yeah, you've got to transition between these crack systems, and the granite is pretty featureless usually when you get out of the cracks. So there's just a few that they're boulder problems really, because it's not very far to actually get between the cracks, but there's some quite hard climbing down there, and it's really insecure, and you're standing on tiny holds. It's pretty hot and we're kind of nervous. There was a few sort of hairy moments. Alex had a few falls. Both of our like shoes were like rolling, and like the rubber was sort of peeling off because it was really warm on these tiny little smears, and it wasn't super confidence inspiring.
Because I was going to say, like, how were you sort of like, you know, you've worked on the pitches and you're setting off knowing that really it's now.
Yes.
This is the time you're bringing it all together. How were the nerves? How was it? Setting off. Could you sleep the night before as well?
I don't think I slept particularly well the night before. I actually slept really well the first night up there because we were really tired. But I was trying to just sort of like take it just one step at a time. Like, this is where we're trying to get to today. Let's think about what we've got to do today. And now think about tomorrow. And that was made it much easier to manage and make it feel more reasonable.
Is that something you'd pulled from your comp, like, but you know, like your past experience? Because, you know, it must be really nerve-wracking the night before a comp and when you turn up at a comp.
Again, with competitions, like, especially with bouldering round, it's very much like you have this boulder in front of you. This is your focus right now. Pour all of your energy into that. Then your 5 minutes is done. Forget about that. Focus on the next one. We definitely teach ourselves to have that very sort of singular focus and to block out the things which aren't important in that moment. I definitely think I was doing that kind of the whole way through it. Like, this is what I need to do now. Now I'll think about the next thing.
You've done something and it's been a bit tricky or you've fallen off, just be like, that's done. Forget about that.
Yeah,
that's done.
The next thing. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Those first couple of days went relatively smoothly. There was nothing that went really wrong, even if we had like a few sort of hairy moments. Alex got his knee stuck in an off whip and had a bit of a panic.
What a horrible feeling.
Fortunately, I haven't had this feeling, but he was on one of like the easy pitches where we're trying to move relatively quickly. We didn't have an abundance of big cams of us because we were trying not to go too heavy, so we were doing like relatively big run outs on those terrain because we weren't going to fall off, hopefully. he got relatively far above his last piece, then suddenly he was a bit less happy than me on the kind of like number four sized off width. I think that's probably a body size thing. He's a bit smaller than me. He was kind of like sinking into them a bit more, whereas I was getting quite a lot from them. Yes, he sort of got a little bit stressed, sank his knee in for a bit of respite, and then suddenly couldn't get it out anymore. Probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 metres above his last piece. And then was like, wiggling it around, like shouting back down to me, like, "Billy, I'm a bit stuck," and I can't do anything about that. Now I'm just like, "Nah, you're all right, mate. Just like wiggle it out. It'll come out. It's fine." And then he eventually like did get it out, but it was such a jerk that I could see, even though it was 30 meters away, he kind of went like all the way out from the wall,
sort of like leaning back, like this, almost overbalanced.
Let out this whip, and then sort of like wind his way to the top.
I think that's the interesting thing about these sorts of routes is that you can be such a talented climber, you can be climbing really well, you can be capable of climbing the changing corners, such a hard route. There's just so many moves on a big wall.
Yeah, there's so many opportunities. There's so many opportunities to mess up.
You really have to, you really have to kind of build that confidence in a lot of styles and be okay to do lots of moves and types of movements that you would maybe shy away from. If you weren't choosing to climb a pitch, one pitch, you probably wouldn't bother with that pitch because you'd be like, "Oh, I don't particularly like that size." You know, maybe I'd be like, "Oh, I don't really like size fours." But that's just not an option.
Yeah, like, well, we've got to go up it somehow. So, we were a bit quiet at the beginning after that one.
Yeah, that's cool. So then you get like, you know, you're starting to like just get set up on Portal Edge and you're kind of really in that big wall experience. What did you take with you? I'm always interested about this because I've been in Yosemite and some people talk about not even taking a stove to have cups of tea. And I'm always interested what people take for morale.
So I think we, if anything, we were over-prepared in that regard. We had a stove with us.
Too much morale.
Maybe so. We had a lot of food. We'd rationed for a lot of food and quite a lot of sort of nice little sweet treats to have in the evening to like keep us going. So I don't, did we have anything like really particular?
You know, you're a bit like at the end of a day like that, you're like, oh, get to have this.
Yeah, we had a nice little selection of teas that we'd like rationed out so that we could have a nice, he had some sleepy tea, I had some peppermint tea, which we both liked to have in the evenings. Alex had these, what are they called? Like space brownies or something that he like really likes, the total trash brownie food, but just some like nice comfort thing for West Europe, basically. We did have quite a lot of food. I was kind of expecting to come away from the trip like some wiry little Rafe from rations, and I came back like heavier than when I left, which I wasn't expecting. So maybe we rationed a little bit too well.
But I think Tom Randall has actually said that before. I think because you're doing so much work and
you eat a huge amount,
which you need, you really want to be in that surplus, and it's also just such a different type of work for your body, isn't it? But I'm pretty sure Tom Randall came back and was like, "Huh, that's interesting, I'm heavier than
work." With this astronomical metabolism because of the amount of work that we've been doing. The Portal Edge, I borrowed it from Tom. He very kindly lent me the Portal Edge and the fly for it. It's quite an old Portal Edge. And me and Alex hadn't thought to like check the fly, like make sure the fly was properly waterproofed and stuff. We like, it just hadn't been something that we considered. We were just like, it'll just work, obviously. And we've never, neither of us ever been getting rained on before on a Portal Edge. So none of this we'd really considered. We set it up. It started to rain. We weren't getting as much cover from being under the great roof as we thought we were going to. We were getting hit by the rain, and it became apparent quite quickly that the fly wasn't as waterproof as we maybe hoped it was.
Tom Randall, sandbagging you.
I mean, he still lent us a fly, which is more than we would have had otherwise. So it was, we were getting quite damp quite quickly. And with any material, when it's like not particularly waterproof, as soon as you touch it, it just seeps straight through into you, and you're in a confined space, so you're more or less touching it all of the time because it's like there's just not space not to be. So yeah, it it got pretty damp. We were sort of getting like puddles underneath our thermarests. That was the one moment where like we're not properly prepared for this, and it could get bad. But fortunately, it never got quite to that point. We just had two very damp, unpleasant nights where I think both of us were very much not having fun anymore, and sort of being like, "Well, I don't really want to be here now." But we forged on, and we actually, after having 2 days of rubbish weather, we then did actually go really in our favour in that we had it stopped raining, the sun came out. So we had half a day to get all of our stuff dried out in the sun. And then the temperature plummeted to the point that it was snowing, basically. But the great roof directly above us was bone dry. So yeah, we kind of suddenly had these favourable conditions. And like, right, now is the moment. We need to get through this pitch and carry on upwards. Or we're going to start running out of time.
Yeah, did it feel quite easy then to switch the motivation back on? Because it's a bit of a funny, if you've been at the point of being like, oh, should we go down?
I would not say that was easy. No. So had that first go to sort of like get a bit more of a sense of the situation. Alex had had his go. How did his first attempt go? It was sort of all right. He fell off getting into the roof, but both of our first goes were kind of just like remembering. But then the second go for me was one of the more special moments on the entire route. Like, as I said, the weather had kind of come in and it was literally snowing all around me whilst I was up on this pitch. And considering you're on this vast space, it suddenly felt quite sort of small, and like the environment kind of closes down on you and you feel in your sort of own little bubble, and that was probably the what felt like the best bit of climbing for me, going through that pitch. I just like everything went right, felt really flowy in the zone, the whole situation just felt perfect. It was a really special, magical moment, and everything went well. I had this sort of big release of stress, like you've done the first hard pitch, suddenly starts to feel a bit more real that like it might happen. But we then have the first situation of having one of us being sort of ahead of the other. And then Alex is in this situation where he's got time for one more go before it gets dark. And we'd not done any climbing in the dark. It wasn't really something that we prepared for. So he was like, okay, I've got one more go today before I need to do it, and then I'd have to do it tomorrow. If I do it tomorrow, then it takes up another day and it's one less day for changing corners, and the weather is good now. For him, he very much felt like, I have to do this climb.
That was it.
This is my moment. Yeah. Like, I need to do the pitch. And like, it wasn't, I wouldn't say he was less confident than me on the Great Roof in general. And setting off on that, I wouldn't have said he didn't look confident to me. But he went fully in that sort of cop mindset of like, I am going to make this happen.
I am literally not letting go.
And like, he made mistakes early on getting into the roof and was like power screaming way earlier on the pitch than I thought was reasonable. And like, when I was working it, I'd had a couple of goes where I'd fallen off the very last move in the roof and I just pumped out, because Great Roof is probably the only pitch on the route which is like properly pumpy in like a sport climbing way. It's pumpy for the legs as well as the hands, but like, you could just pump out. Alex was just battling from really early on. And then got to this very last move where I'd fallen off a couple of times and was like going through for this cross under. It was cool to watch because like, the climb didn't go well for him. He fully just forced it out. So that he needs to do it.
And I suppose it's interesting there, like with the partnership, to have that comparison of the two experiences on a pitch. Because something I think obviously that's a massive tribute to Alex's tenacity of just not letting go. But something I really like about multi-pitch experiences, and it depends whether you've shared projects so closely with a partner off a big wall, But, you know, you're trying the same pitches. You always are. Whereas I guess often, like, if we go with our friends to the crag or even, like, quite a dedicated climbing partner, you're not always so in these same pitches together. Yeah. Like, really, like, watching, it's special for you, your experience on it. But it also would have been special for Alex watching you climb it in that way. And when you flip it and you know it so intimately as well and you can see the battle that someone's having. I think you really get the... I think that's part of the partnership that I love on big walls as well.
There's no other scenario in climbing where I've been as invested in somebody else's performance.
Yeah.
Which is a really cool thing. Like, I was excited when I did the Great Roof, but we've not succeeded on the pitch at
that
point.
Yeah, we haven't.
So I was more excited when Alex did the pitch, and like, we knew that we were both going on from that point. And yeah, watching Alex's fight to get through it was really special for me. I was really excited when he got through it.
So it sounds like the Great Roof was one of those standout moments. And actually, it's always interesting with multi-pitches. It's like, this wasn't the top of the climb.
No.
But, you know, this real special moment happened, what, maybe actually about midway up. And you've already sort of like slightly touched on the fact that it was maybe a bit of a role reversal on the changing corners.
Yeah.
So maybe we dive into how that went. Now that you're up there, I mean, you're many days in on the wall. You've not actually linked the sequence anyway when you've practiced it. Yeah, how did that all sort of play out?
Yeah, so we had, once we got through Great Roof, we had a sort of more chilled day where we got up four pitches in between. So we had like quite a relaxed one when we did those four pitches, got ourselves set up at Camp 6 below the Great Roof, below Changing Corners, sorry. And with Changing Corners...
not easy at that time in the morning.
And like, neither me or Alex are morning people. Like, this is always something that we struggled with comps, of like having to get out of bed and just be like switched on and ready to go straight away. So in some regards, I think it was quite helpful that even though we really struggle with that, we've been forced to do it a lot in the past for competitions, and like we kind of applied a similar routine to the same situation. I had
my first go. It was all right. I fell off kind of where I was expecting to. Like, I'd done a bit of the first sort of tricky sequence, and then there's this transition move where you've been in the groove and you're coming back out again, and you're putting a lot of weight through this one smear in order to move your weight back out, and I'd had a lot of trouble with this foot just picking off, basically. So my foot came off there about what I expected for my first go. It wasn't really a positive or a negative at that point. Then Alex went off for his second go, and he did it. As I said, he looked better on the pitch and was a bit more consistent than me. So I was kind of anticipating this. I knew he was capable of doing it quite quickly. And like, he had a fight. No, it didn't quite all go to plan. His climbing went perfectly to plan. But the knee pad that he had on, for whatever reason, just slid off his knee. So for like the last third of the pitch, he was like, it was fully just like round his ankles, trying to get through the moves. Which is obviously is bad for him, but he's got a knee pad around his ankles. But it's also like, if the knee pad came off,
yeah, like, don't drop the knee pad.
I'm done. Like, I can't do the pitch without the knee pad. So he's got this like.
He didn't take a spare knee pad then.
No, he didn't take a spare knee pad. No. So he's got this like, he's got to manage this knee pad around his ankles whilst trying to be conscious of my ascent as well, and like not ruining it for both of us. But yeah, he managed to get through it, and I got to the jog and got the knee pad on, and really amazing moment for him. I was really psyched. But sort of almost also balanced with this kind of bit of a feeling of dread of, Alex has done the hard pitch. He's going to go to the top now. Like, there's nothing above this that's going to stop him. If it's all on me now for the team ascent. And I, as I said, I didn't feel as good on the pitch. I'd never linked it. We're however many days up from that point, and I've got this finite time limit to do the pitch. I was stressed. I was really stressed.
And it's the dynamic shift, isn't it? Because this is where, like, obviously the partnership, like, Alex is so there for you.
Yeah.
But for him, he's probably thinking, right, now how do I do to create, like, a good environment for you?
Yeah.
And it can be so hard to get that right.
Yeah, like, no, Alex was great. He went fully into support mode.
Yeah.
I had two more red points that day. I made a high point, promising, but it didn't necessarily feel like I was going to do it imminently. I did feel I had a high point. I probably felt the best on it that I had, so it was encouraging. But there's so many things that could go wrong. So the sun came out, and then we just got to sit out the whole day until the next morning when I can have goes again. So you just sort of go like a stew there and try not to think too much about this pitch that's looming above you, which is like stopping you from achieving your goal. Alex is like kind of chilling, like he's having a great time, he's done it, but he's also trying to be really conscious of me and being supportive. And he was really good, like trying to sort of draw me away from stewing on it too much. Like if I was like, I would be there like staring at my skin or something like that, and he'd just try and like make some like nice comments to distract me for a little bit. But ultimately, I kind of just had to sit there and try and make peace with the situation and try and be okay with not doing it. I kind of said earlier on, like, we went into it being really open and not having too many expectations, being okay with not doing it. But by that point, when one of us is going to be successful and you're very close to it, quite difficult to detach from it. I really, really wanted to do that.
Yeah, it's always easier said than done, isn't it? And I guess with a lot of other projects, when you walk away from them at the end of a session, you go home, you get distracted, you watch some TV, like, you know, you're not sat underneath the pitch with the pitch sort of bearing down on
you. Exactly.
And so, you know, I think it's much harder to get that kind of detached from it. For days, like, your world has now been this root, literally living on it.
Yeah, like that's the only thing.
So I think it's definitely different to detach from it.
Yeah, and it's not like you just come back next week or whatever. Literally, my flight home is in 2 days' time.
Yeah,
I've got.
It's really like now.
Yeah, I've got two mornings to do it. I need to make it happen or be okay with not doing it. Basically.
Yeah.
Do
you feel like that time then you more lent to kind of just processing being okay with not doing it?
I was working on. Yeah. I can't say that I was
rather than like raring up, because guess what? Yes. The flip side is you could be like really raring up and being like, I can definitely do this. This is like, you know, I guess people like different things.
Mm.
I definitely tend to lean towards processing, really being okay with not doing it, like what's actually going to happen if I don't do this route. Obviously nothing ever happens.
Yeah.
And you know, and kind of because I find that almost like a lower pressure situation. Like, did you do that, or from your past experience, do you enjoy a bit of like raring up and being like, come on, you can do this?
I'd say I was working really hard on trying to be kind of detached from the situation, or detached from the outcome of the situation. I wouldn't say I was totally successful with that. I do also kind of relish those stressful situations as well. Like, I've had that so much from competing. It's something that I have sucked out in climbing. Through that whole day, I was very much trying to avoid being excited about it. And then I was kind of trying to save that excitement, trying to rev myself up for the next morning. And trying to find some pleasure in that situation. Which in the moment, it doesn't really feel like pleasure. It's because it's just so stressful. But just trying to tell myself that, like, this is a this is a rewarding and memorable experience to like get the best out of, and that can be positive success or failure.
And you always, I always think like, because I've done big roles that I've not totally freed, you know, and I guess as a percentage, like the proportion of moves you haven't done,
is really low.
You know, I guess like, you know, like for a boulder or a sport route, you know, once you get to a big ball, you're like, gosh, you've done so much. And yeah, I often find that like thought quite kind of makes me feel much more calm and like less nervous about not doing one pitch or one set of moves on a pitch.
The experience that you've had is practically the same, right? If it's like a couple of moves that have separated you, like the experience is pretty much the same whether you succeed or fail. It's just your perception of it.
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure if I really did have that thought process very much when I stopped there, but I like that a lot. That's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, well, me and a partner climbed a route called the Shaft, but we got rained on. And I mean, it was a hard route for me. And we actually bailed upwards and then abbed back in and sent the crux pitch. We hadn't gone from the ground. So that was definitely like a big experience for me. It was so hard for me at the time. Like, you know, I had no expectations that I would do it. Did more than expected, but obviously didn't free the route. I definitely feel like that was maybe like how this will be for you. There was like a lot that I learned about kind of success and failure and how you talk about these things and how you feel about them. Which now I can take with me, like, you know, you might take this with you also. So did you do it the next morning?
Next morning, it was kind of nice that it was now it was only me working on it, and we didn't need to be like trading red point attempts. Like, Alex was fully in support mode, so I could just totally do my thing. My first go, I matched my high point, which in theory is kind of encouraging for the first go of the day, but my skin felt awful. I think this was from just like living on the wall and like being in a sleeping bag and just like stewing in your own filth basically for like a week. My skin was just, it was the sweatiest it's ever been, to the point that I put chalk on it and the chalk would just sort of turn into a paste. And I was just getting no friction out of the holds. And I got to this high point basically feeling like I was just sliding through every position. And even though I got to this move that I was struggling with, it just felt like there was nothing more for me to give, and like that was the best effort that I could really have given in this scenario. So I came down from the first go that day, like, pretty dejected. I think Alex was trying to, like, bring me back out of it a little bit, but that was kind of the low moment for me, where I dropped away from that sort of relative optimism of, it might not happen, but, like, I'm definitely capable of it. I didn't really feel like I could do it in that moment, and was just stressing about my skin, basically. The solution to this, which is kind of classic for me, was I do a ridiculous amount of arm waving. If you just like see me in the climbing wall or whatever.
Okay, I was going to ask about your prep.
I'm like flapping my arms around all the time, basically. And it's not really something you can do on a big wall in the same way, because I would like, if I'm like prepping up for a boulder or something, I kind of go through this process of swinging my arms and like taking some breaths and focusing on it. And I think anybody that's like got to a high level of sport, they have these kind of rituals that they go through and sort of focus them. And I'd not really been able to do that through this whole experience. But before the crux section, the changing corners, there is this no hands rest. And so I kind of got there and adjusted my ritual to kind of fit that scenario, and just sort of spent loads of time there, just like wafting my hands around, calming myself down, waiting until I got this like sense of coolness of the air flowing over my fingers, which sounds
well. I think that I've spoke to a climber recently and she was scared, and she said, yeah, when her hands feel sweaty, you know, I think you can feel cool, calm and collective, And I think maybe, you know, like our touch is really, you know, our hands are where we're in contact with the block. So I think that really makes sense.
But it was like this double whammy of it. It was actually cooling my skin down, but it was also allowing me to get into that mindset and just go through the process that I've always done for hard climbing. And just sort of
applying it to this new situation.
And like feeling ready for the situation, basically. And had my second go of that day, and it was way worse than the previous go. I fell off much lower down from the foot slip, but I came off it really positive again because I felt the contact with the rock and felt like I was moving how I should.
That's where like the simple measure of how far you get, like
it doesn't line up
totally
at all.
Breaks down
in
these sorts of situations.
I'd probably been 6 or 7 moves higher the previous go, but I'd come off it way less confident. So lower back down, was feeling much better about it, but I've probably got sub an hour of time before the sun comes around at this point. And then an aid party came up behind us and arrived on the ledge. And it's a weird one with big walling. Essentially, if there's a party that's moving faster than you, the kind of etiquette is to let them through. This is a kind of niche scenario where I've got this weather window where I can perform. So I kind of need to be selfish in this scenario for my chance of success, but doesn't really sit very well with me either, being like, right, you guys are going to have to wait for me, which is affecting their experience.
Also, to have people there watching
suddenly
you
had a bit of an audience
is also
as well.
Bit disconcerting when it's just been the two of you in your own little bubble.
Yeah, so like they came up and they were like super psyched and like happy to just let me have a go. But it very much felt like the weather is coming in, these two guys are waiting. Like, I don't feel like I can make them wait for another go whilst I just sit and lounge around trying to like prepare. So it felt like a now or never moment for me. In reality, it wasn't quite like we did have one more day's worth of food. But I was sat in that rest again, going through my prep, feeling like very much like this is the moment to do it. Just trying to get into that mindset, basically. And went for that go and nothing quite went wrong, basically. It didn't feel perfect. It wasn't like the Great Roof where I really felt like I was in a flow state and everything just sort of happened. Like, I felt like I was fighting and I was very like conscious of what was going on. Like, I sort of felt like I had that self-talk, like, oh, I'm not falling off yet. I'm getting closer. Like, come on, like, don't mess it up now. And that was very prevalent in my head whilst going through it. And I could feel that kind of building up the further I got up, and I got through this move that I'd fallen off a couple more times before, and then it seemed like, don't mess it up now, like, this is the moment to get it, to make it happen. And then it's kind of nice, once you get through the hard climbing, you just get given this huge victory jug, and just have this like huge burst of relief. I could just let it out, this sort of guttural cry, basically. And just everything would just sort of wash away from you, and like, realize the situation that you're in. Like, Alex was like screaming up at me, and really special moment.
You get to experience so many emotions, I think, in climbing when it's that sort of kind of build up. You know, there's loads of climbing, maybe like one moment, but I think, I guess, with big walls, just through the time and the investment, it's like there's so much experience buffering that moment and feeding
exactly.
into it.
Yeah.
I think it does make it pretty powerful.
Yeah, and that's something that me and Alex had spoken about quite a bit, where what we'd really valued from competing was the sort of intensity of the experiences that it gives you. And neither of us had ever had that same degree of intensity from a rock climbing experience, because always just come back the next day or whatever, like, and the stakes never have felt as high to us as in a competition where like the boulder is in front of you, the crowd is there screaming your support, and like you need to make it happen in that moment. But this felt
kind of like that.
Felt like almost exactly the same to me. Like, we've had months of prep building up to this. We spent all this time working on the route, like conceptualizing this idea. We've come up from the bottom, like sat out this rainstorm, got through the lower pitches. We've got this time limit of needing to fly home in a couple of days. And I need to perform on this pitch, which feels pretty damn on my limit, and I've never linked it before. There's just so much building up to that moment. And yeah, like the sort of release from that afterwards, having succeeded, was probably more intense than any moment that I've ever had in a competition.
That's cool.
Which is, yeah, really, really special, because it's kind of bringing the, it full circle, I suppose, of like we having retired from competitions and not really knowing where to go next, and then setting this goal, and yeah, then having experience from it that was on a par or if not better than anything we had from comps is, yeah, just special.
Did it then feel like a real grind to get to the top? Like, you know, just the fatigue hit you, you know, when you're kind of like, you've also really been holding out for this pitch, and sometimes, you know, when there's that realization of, oh, we have done it, but you're not actually at the top.
Not really done it, yeah. Like, it's this huge sense of joy. I like, abseil back down, like, massive hug of Alex, like, sharing that moment, which is really special. Then, yeah, we've still got five pitches to go, and then we've still got to get all of our stuff together, we've still got to get back down. Like, we're, the goal isn't finished, and we're still in a really serious situation. And yeah, I think we both kind of had a bit of a sort of lull after that, where
everything, you can suddenly feel how hard everything feels,
I think. And just getting through these few pitches, which are grade-wise much easier, suddenly felt like quite a big undertaking.
I've always had it like, you realise how tired you are, you realise how much it's taken you actually to get to that point. I think sometimes you're riding on the emotions, the motivation, the adrenaline, and I think then there's this realisation of, oh, I'm actually exhausted.
And there's quite a poignant moment from this, actually. Alex set off up the pitch, and we was just going to do some climbing and then go through the gear, because he's already done the pitch, and get up to current leading. And basically, he started tying his knot, got distracted by doing something else, and then set off up the start of the pitch, having not finished his knot. Fortunately, he realised a few metres up in a position where he could take off both his hands and sort it out, and it was all totally fine. But it, because it was, if that was the situation where, I'm not saying this very well.
He's let his guard down.
Basically, yeah, we've had this big, big moment of joy and feel like we've kind of achieved what we've set out to do, and his guard is down, and suddenly he makes a really serious mistake because you're not on it. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's that really scary.
Could have been horrendous.
Yeah.
That
almost pulls you back into where you're really at.
It was almost
3,000 feet up.
Wake up call to us again. Yeah. Like, we've not actually done this. This is still really serious. Like, sort our shit out, basically. Like, we need to get ourselves to the top and finish this thing off. So, fortunately, totally fine. But reminder that big walling is dangerous. Remember to keep your head switched on until it's actually finished.
I mean, I think it's an amazing story, and I think it sounds like it had so many kind of big moments in it, and I think it's also cool just to go through that transition with someone else who you've literally done your comp career with. I guess I've got two more questions, which are, one is, I know that you shared your process along the way on social media, which a lot of people do now, but I'm just always interested how that felt alongside such a big project, because I personally have not always found that easy, and so I'm just always interested. And then the last thing is just like, I don't know whether there was like some sort of main takeaway from this experience and how it might have changed you as a climber. And I know you've talked about some of these real standout moments, but Yeah, I don't know whether there was like something that you learned that you sort of actually hadn't really realised before. Mm.
Yeah, so with sharing it on social media, it was something that we wanted to do with it from the very beginning. Like it's we were putting ourselves on this journey that was going to be very new for us, and we were doing a lot of learning, and we were sort of hoping that it would be a good story to tell, kind of irrespective of the outcome. So yeah, we were very intentional in sharing as much of what we were doing as we could, which was something quite new for both of us. Like, do it for it to a certain extent as a competition climber, but it's like, this competition went well, this competition went less well, and that does teach you to sort of share less positive moments, I suppose, but it felt very different compared to a really specific objective. And it was really cool. People got really excited about it.
I think it was great. I guess just compared to a lot of things, it was still very ongoing. You were still in it.
Yeah.
I suppose when you've reflected on like a comp and you share that,
it's after the fact.
It's sort of after the fact, where I guess this was, part of the reason it's interesting is that you were really in it.
It was like
updates.
Yeah, and we really did get a sense of this sort of community of people that were behind us and really excited about what we were doing, which is really cool. But did add a level of stress for me as well, because a lot of people were excited about it, and I kind of didn't want to let people down, I suppose. Like, we were getting loads of words of support, and kind of just wanted to make it happen for all the people that were following along with it as well. One of the best points of that actually was when we were sat in a rainstorm for 2 days, not having the best time. We got quite a lot of messages from people, like total strangers, basically just being like, oh, we're following along, really cool what you're doing, stick it out, basically. And that was pretty big for me, knowing that people are like rooting for you, basically, it got us through some of the tougher moments. And it was just really cool that people got psyched about it, really.
I mean, this is total personal bias, but I think the Big Walls come with good stories.
I agree. Yeah, they, as you said earlier, like there's so many parts to it that go beyond just a normal climbing success story. There's a lot more sort of like personal experiences and emotions and things which is relatable to a lot of people, I think. Everything is sort of exaggerated by the scenario, isn't it?
Yeah. And do you, I mean, obviously, you've been climbing so many years, and obviously you've just taken a lot of your experiences and learning into this, into climbing LCAP, and you've come out the other side. Did you feel like there was anything new that it taught you, or that you sort of felt in this experience, or did it just kind of build on a lot of what you had done? Because I guess people have this sense, don't they, that like, gosh, climbing LCAP's so different to competition, which obviously it is in so many senses. But you've actually sort of laid out a lot of how there was some crossover, these kind of having to perform in the moment, and I guess having this partnership, obviously, on the GB team, you're like sort of, you kind of, like the competitors also really supporting each other, and it's a little bit like that on a big wall as well.
Yeah, I actually think psychologically and tactically, I don't think we learned many new things. It really felt like we were applying stuff that we'd learned from competing. Obviously, logistically, we learned an astronomical amount because we were literally just going from the ground up. Like, we were barely competent trad climbers, let alone competent big wallers. Technically, I definitely felt like we did a lot of learning in like being proficient moving through quite easy terrain. Felt like a big one.
Yeah.
Being able to go through 5'9", 5'10", crack climbing without it feeling like a battle.
I actually think that's often quite a struggle for British climbers, and I know I've felt that, and I know other people have said the same. It's like we just don't have much terrain like that.
Not at all, really.
And it's a totally different way of moving and giving in to the sort of style.
And then, kind of as I mentioned, with changing corners, like climbing with more than just four points, and the intuition that you mentioned of allowing your body to go where it feels right rather than trying to be too regimented with what you think is right, I suppose.
That's really cool. Well, I mean, it's been so nice to be able to sit here and for that. That was great.
My pleasure.